Good morning and welcome to Backchat. I'm Hugh Chiverton, your co-host today, Danny Gittings. Danny, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Today, the future of tourism and the book fair. Labour and Welfare Secretary Lo Chee Kwong said this week that the government cannot keep funding the tourism industry with no end in sight to the pandemic. The government had offered at least $2.6 billion worth of relief measures for the tourism sector to cope with COVID-19. Ms. Law also said the practical thing to do is to try to help people working in sectors that are struggling to change jobs. The statement sparked concern within the sector. Yesterday, the chief executive in LegCo said the tourism industry is one of the key pillars of the SAR's economy and the sector has a rosy future. She said, though, that Hong Kong needs to fix its negative image as she complained that some people are driving others away from the city. Well, how do you think the tourism sector is doing? Why should tax dollars keep supporting it? Does it have, realistically, a viable future? Let us know your thoughts. You can leave a message on our Facebook page, Backchat and RTHK Radio 3. You can email us, backchat at rthk.hk, or you can call us on 233 88266, 233 88266. And after 9:15, we're going to be talking about the book fair. Now on, the first amid the pandemic and after the imposition of the national security law. Chip Cho will be joining us for his thoughts on that issue. On other issues, some emails related to our discussion yesterday on the bit about plastic and microplastics in our streams. Jim H. says natural evaporation happens. Rain from evaporated ocean waters can fall into reservoirs. Many Hong Kong hiking people do not use disposable water bottles. Jem says on the we've got a few with a common theme here. Says Jem says, why let your female co-presenter constantly interrupt and talk over other people this morning? Not good. Din says, perhaps you could crack your whip in future and control the conversation. The first half of today's program was a cacophony of angry women shouting unintelligibly over each other. Samgo loyan yak go hoi.
Well done.
Can you translate that?
Nope.
Okay, that's my pronunciation, I'm sure. And Tommy says, Hugh, can you ask Nixie to stop interrupting and talking over the callers and guests? It's not the same as guiding the conversation. And on today's issue, TC says on Facebook, the tourism industry, among others, is paying for the government's unrealistic policy for zero cases. Most of the world has come to the shifted their focus on vaccination, managing the virus, and simply not let cases swamp the medical system. That's from TC. Once again, our email is backchat at rthk.hk.
Our guest in the main section of the show this morning in our Queensway studio, we have David Webb, founder and editor of website.com, and also joining us, Ronald Wu, who's the chairman of the Hong Kong Association of Travel Agents, and Professor Haiyan Song, Associate Dean at the School of Hotel and Tourism Management at Hong Kong Polytechnic University. Good morning, Professor Song. Let's go to you first. Professor Song, you of course, are teaching students who want to go into the tourism industry. Does the tourism industry have a future in Hong Kong, and are you seeing concern among your students?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for inviting me to the show. And of course, there is a future for tourism in Hong Kong. And although temporarily the tourism industry and the related sectors has been affected, but definitely once the pandemic is over and tourists will return to Hong Kong from different parts of the world, and they still need people to work in the industry. So, yes, the still future, I don't see there's any significant change in terms of demand for Hong Kong tourism in the future.
Well, what did you make in that case of the Labour Secretary, Lo Chee Kwong's remarks, when he's basically suggesting people should move to other industries instead?
I think currently, because of the drastic decline in tourism demand in the city, and there people perhaps are thinking to change their career to other sectors. But in the long run, when the tourists return, you still need tourism product and services to meet the requirement of future tourism. Yes, temporarily there may be some changes, but in the long run, I think tourism will remain the same.
How long run are you thinking? I mean, a lot of people talk about 2024 at the very earliest, and these estimates keep getting put back, don't they?
Yes. Actually, there are different forecasts, right, different scenarios. According to our forecast, we did do a forecast for Asia-Pacific in terms of tourism demand. The recovery will be in batches in terms of the destinations. I think some of the destinations will open up earlier. Others will be late, depend on the pandemic situation in their respective countries or regions. Hong Kong, in terms of Hong Kong, we will project that by the end of 2020, tourists will recover.
21, you mean?
Oh. 22, sorry.
22.
The end of 22, sorry. The end of 22 will recover to probably close to the pre-pandemic level. And also, this is all to do with many policies and measures, including vaccination. I think the only way for the future of tourism in Hong Kong and also other countries we see in Asia Pacific is to get people, you know, vaccinated. If we reach to say 70% of population being vaccinated, and then tourism will certainly will recover. You know, the confidence will be built. So I'm a little bit more optimistic than others.
That is a very optimistic forecast, because you're basically saying in just over a year's time, things will be back to where they were before the pandemic.
Yeah, roughly, not exactly, but, you know, in terms of the demand, you will see a strong recovery along the way.
Okay. And you think the government should sort of continue the support they've been giving in the past for travel agents, for Cathay and hotels and employers and so on until this ends, until the
personally, I think they should. The government should continue to support, although the government has generally supported the industry over the past year or so. Actually, there were three supporting scheme being launched, and lately in February budget speech, actually there was another over 900 million promised to the industry, to support the industry, and also another 765 million also allocated to Hong Kong Tourism Board to, you know, set up the promotion and revive the industry. So the effort has already been made financially to the industry. I think yes, the industry would hope there will be more support to come, but at the same time, the current support still can be used to revitalize the industry.
Also joining us is Ronald Wu, Chair of the Hong Kong Association of Travel Agents. Mr. Wu, good morning. Now, you just heard very optimistic projection by Professor Sung suggesting things will be back to normal by basically the end of next year. Are you that optimistic, or do you think it's going to take longer or sooner?
I'm definitely also optimistic, but at the same time, I think looking at it, the vaccination rate is going to be the key for us in terms of how long the recovery is going to take. If we look at examples in China and in the U.S. During this past July 4th weekend, domestic travel has resumed to where it was pre-COVID, and that's because which shows that, you know, people are actually eager to travel. It's just that they're not allowed to do so. But once we get the vaccination up, and you know, we're loosening up these social distancing rules, less quarantine time, you know, we're very optimistic that people will travel again, and Hong Kong will continue to be one of the top destinations of choice in Asia for either people from China or Southeast Asia or around the world, just like it was pre-COVID.
But even with double vaccination, we're still talking about 7 days in quarantine, and even then, that's all kinds of restrictions. You have to have the right test for antibodies. How many travelers are going to come and spend 7 days in quarantine to spend their holiday in Hong Kong?
The quarantine period definitely needs to be reduced for those that meet these requirements of doing antibody tests or, you know, having two vaccinations. And that's another point I want to mention. People will, in the future, travel will not be as simple as it was before. Just buy a flight ticket, book a hotel, and you're able to go anywhere you want. there's going to be a lot of work that you can do before and after. And the role of travel agents becomes more important because nowadays people would actually, they don't want to plan the trips on them by themselves because it's a lot more complicated than it was before. So we need to keep our talents in the industry so that when the recovery period comes, we believe that travel agents will be more important so than before because of these, you know, more complicated preparations that you do before you allow to travel again.
Mr. Wheeler, like I say, you know, you've had no business, presumably, like zero business for a year and a half or something.
Yes.
How do you survive? How does your industry survive at all?
Well, I mean,
how do you pay the rent?
From the owner perspective, you know, we're trying our best to cut down as much cost as possible to survive. If we look at the record, the number of travel agents in Hong Kong hasn't reduced much, meaning that, you know, people are doing whatever the best they can, you know, taking their savings out to try to survive the storm, because all of us still believe that once the pandemic is over, the demand for travel exists. And in terms of staff, you know, we are allowing staff to look for short-term part-times, allow them to find alternative source of income during this period of time. But at the end of the day, what we want to see is they all would like to come back and work in the hospitality industry once the pandemic is over. It has been a very, very difficult 18 months, we must say.
Because you have a subsidy of what? It's about $10,000 a head, effectively, is it, for people working in travel agents?
I think it's $10,000 per head for each employer.
That's not going to last very long, is it? That's
No. It might just pay a
few
months.
Keep
rent,
going, yeah.
All.
Yeah. All right, David Webb, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us, and congratulations on your 30 years.
Yes.
In Hong Kong. Interesting messages on your website. Good to see you. What do you make of this? So you have Lau Chi Kwong and the CE saying rather kind of
differing
things. Yeah.
Oh, dear. He's dropped the party line, hasn't he?
he'll be back in line in a day or two, won't he?
Probably, but walking backwards rapidly and bowing at the same time. I mean, you know, he's actually speaking the truth that unless the government has some intention of opening our borders again, there's not going to be a meaningful resumption in travel. It's not a matter of reducing quarantine times or creating some gravy train for the travel agents of multiple testing before and after flights and so on, as Mr. Wu suggested. That's not going to bring back a large amount of cross-border travel. We actually have to get back to the stage, as we did with measles, where we don't test people for measles before they get on the plane. We just assume that enough people in the world have been vaccinated that it's not a major problem. And that's where most countries are heading. They haven't got there yet, but many of them have dropped their domestic restrictions and are gradually moving towards open borders. And if we set a time frame and told our population that on a certain date in the future, maybe 4 months from now, that we would allow fully vaccinated travellers in without testing, without quarantine, and then soon after that, anybody in without testing and quarantine, then that would rapidly stimulate the remaining people to get vaccinated and produce herd immunity in Hong Kong, as we already have with measles, and then we wouldn't care. It's a highly infectious disease, measles, but if we've got herd immunity, anyone who wants the vaccine has the opportunity to get one, then travel of people into Hong Kong and out again isn't a problem. And a large proportion of the travel in and out of Hong Kong, it's not just tourism, of course, it's business. It's things like meetings and incentives, conventions and exhibitions, or MICE, as they say, and sports events like the Rugby Sevens, where people come for a long weekend to enjoy the bars and restaurants and hotels of Hong Kong and then spend money at the event itself.
We're not
and those people are not going to be spending 7 days in quarantine or even jumping through multiple hoops to avoid quarantine to get here. That's just such a turn-off because any one of those hoops they might miss and not be able to get in. And so we're going to lose out to places like Singapore that will open up faster. if we don't get a move on. And so I think you know that's whether CK Law was right about the gloomy outlook depends on government policy on the border. But it's, every sign is that the government is aiming to open up the boundary between Hong Kong and the mainland of Macau. Of course, Macau and the mainland already have an open boundary, and join the China bubble. At which point, our policy on international travellers in and out will be driven logically by the mainland's decision, because you can't have people going through the back door of one place that's opened when the other one hasn't. So we'll have to wait until China's ready to open its international borders, and then you have to ask, when would that be? They have to educate or redirect the population towards the goal of manageable COVID rather than zero COVID. So swing round the whole belief that China is somehow COVID-free. And I suspect that we'll get the boundary open to the mainland by the 1st of October, National Day. After all, it is one nation, one country. And then probably not until 1st of July next year will we be talking about opening the international border, and whether that's partial or fully, I don't know.
Well, the boundary is open with China now. It's just you have to go through quarantine if you go into China, isn't it? So
you do.
For Hong Kong, at least for those who are on home visit.
It's partially. We have to go through quarantine. So it's not in that sense. China is still treating Hong Kong as it does other returning residents. In the opposite direction, we do have this return to HK scheme for residents, but not for visitors. There's zero visitors, zero tourists are allowed into Hong Kong at the moment. It's funny that Carrie Lam stood up in LegCo Q&A the other day, question time, and said that certain people have been driving away visitors from Hong Kong. Well, I can think of one person who has banned them from Hong Kong completely. My mum can't visit me in Hong Kong. She'll be on the plane, double vaccinated, just as soon as she's allowed. But,
well, just to follow up on that, we've got a comment from an email. This is from MT, who says, pre-COVID tourism from the mainland was already in a steep decline, so the return to norm means what numbers? Professor Song, yeah, what about that? What Carrie Lam was presumably alluding to there when she was talking about some people driving people away from Hong Kong, and Hong Kong had to fix its negative image. And, you know, we've been hearing there's support for the tourism industry, and there are supposed to be agencies, PR people, you know, who are supposed to relaunch Hong Kong's image and things like this. I mean, apart from the COVID, we've got a lot of problems anyway, haven't we? And especially problems with our neighbours, Professor Song. So does that cast a doubt on our future?
I think that's really an issue. I think Hong Kong need to rebrand itself and to improve its image to tourism from, I think, mainly from mainland China, probably for a few other countries as well. I think Hong Kong has its core products and services in place, and if we actually further to improve our image internationally, we will regain our strength in the mid to long run. In terms of return to normal, it does not necessarily have to be 80 million tourists from China.
Yeah, do you think it'll be different?
I think it will be different. Probably will be high-end tourists, younger tourists, who are probably more technology savvy and looking for lifestyle, urban vibe and that sort of thing. I think the mass tourism era will be gone in the future, so we'll not actually see a lot of tourists from, you know, third tier, fourth tier cities and flocking to China, to Hong Kong. I think that the composition of tourists will be different, and especially the younger generation, probably they will be still very much want to travel to Hong Kong or travel from Hong Kong to other places. I think the product and services need to be changed or refined to meet the new tourists. It will not be the same in terms of numbers, but in terms of volume, in terms of the income, tourism receipt, it will return.
Well, we need to aim to allow the market to direct itself towards premium tourists, and the trouble is that the government has been doing the opposite over the years. They've allocated land for budget three-star hotels and said this piece of land can only be used for that purpose, thereby depressing the land premium revenue from it, rather than requiring hotels to pay up, competing against other demands for land like housing, the result of which would be only luxury hotels aimed at luxury tourists. And then, we'd be more like Paris, perhaps, and attracting people who are going to spend more in the shops, in the restaurants and in the hotels, rather than herds of people following a flag to the nearest jewellery chain to be fleeced under an arrangement with the travel agents.
Yeah, we've got an email from Jeff on that related topic, who says the Hong Kong travel industry previously suffered from classic over-tourism, perilous crowding in some locations like Teck Wah Wan, detrimental change to the retail mix, especially near the boundary, and this also this gave rise to anti-tourist sentiment. What measures can we put in place now to ensure that when tourists return, it is by legitimate tourists and not parallel traders? Introduce a tariff on milk powder, says Jeff. Professor Song, if you want to change the mix and the people who are coming here, how do you do that?
Well, I think there has to be a consolidated effort from all stakeholders in Hong Kong. And we have to change our mindset, and especially given the technology nowadays, actually, all industries, including tourism and hospitality, are driven by technology. So I think there's opportunity, actually. This is, of course, a crisis, but we are facing unprecedented opportunity as well. We need to package ourselves in Hong Kong in terms of the sort of products and services that we will be provided. I think we cannot rely on the old configuration of the tourism industry. Hong Kong has been a shopping paradise for many tourism from China, but now tourists from China do not have to go to Hong Kong to buy things. They can do it in Hainan or their own cities, right? So I think somehow the industry will have to change, and this is the opportunity to make this change.
Ronald Wu, do you agree the travel industry is going to have to change?
Well, I think one thing we have to face is, it seems the focus is always talking about inbound travelers. But there's in our industry alone, we have outbound travelers and inbound travelers. I think it's very equally important that we put our focus on in remembering that Hong Kong's airport is always running in full capacity. And that's why we need the runway before COVID time. People from China, for example, they're able to come to Hong Kong in many different ways, by train, by ferry, high-speed rail. I mean, there's a train departing every 2 minutes from Long Wen, Long Ma Chau, so they can easily come to Hong Kong. And also with these IBS visa policy that the national government has been given us. So the changes cannot come from bottom up. It needs to come from top down, meaning that, we need to have our infrastructure ready. For example, third runway, allowing more flights to land Hong Kong, give them more slots, so that we can have a more balanced and diversified market. But it's not something that can be changed overnight, and we have to accept the fact that it will take some time for the visitors' arrival to reach what it was before, over 60 million. And that's not realistic. We just want to see a gradual resumption of travelers. Let's starting at 10, 15 million, gradually going to 20, 25, so that we can actually resume our economic activities to allow the practitioners to at least stay in the industry and earn some income. So we're not looking at a V-shaped rebound. We're just looking at a gradual, slowly linear increase in the next few years.
Mm. Okay, well, fingers crossed. Mr. Wu, thank you for joining us. Ronald Wu, Chairman of the Hong Kong Association of Travel Agents. Thank you to Professor Haiyan Song, Associate Dean in the School of Hotel and Tourism Management at the Polytechnic University. We're going to be continue the conversation after the news at 9. Also going to be talking about the book fair with Chip Cho. Chip in. Backchat at rthk.hk is the email address. The weather now, it's going to be mainly cloudy. There's sunny intervals and there were a few showers and isolated thunderstorms. The thunderstorm warning in effect now, as well as a very hot weather warning. Light to moderate easterly winds and the outlook unsettled. Occasional showers. 30 degrees now. Relative humidity is at 77%. Welcome back. This is Backchat on a Friday morning with Danny Gittings and me, Hugh Chiverton. We were talking about the future of tourism with those contrasting comments by the Labour and Welfare Secretary and by the Chief Executive this week. Later, we're going to be talking about the book fair now on with Chip Cho. As ever, we want to hear from you. You can give us a call, 233-88266, 233-88266. We haven't got anyone on the line at the moment because we've just got David Webb, founder and editor of website.com in our central studio.
Just.
Yeah. And, okay, some comments on our discussion. Alonso says, Hong Kong's tourism industry, and indeed regional tourism, can only post a sustainable recovery when we open our borders to China. And that may only occur when China adopts a vaccine that is far more effective than its current batch of offerings, Sinovac, Sinopharm, etc., and which is recognised by foreign governments. Yesterday's news that a panel advising the mainland's drug regulators given the green light for the BioNTech vaccine to be administered in China is certainly an encouraging sign, suggesting that pragmatism has trumped national pride and that Beijing may finally have accepted the growing consensus view that its own vaccines are not currently a match for the mRNA options offered by the likes of BioNTech and Moderna. That's from Alonso. And Bob says, on the tourism sector, it's common knowledge that we need to get the vaccination rates up to around 70% for things to open. Now, maybe I missed something here, but I do not believe the tourism sector has done anything to promote vaccine uptake. Instead, they focus their energy on asking for more taxpayer money from the government. Shame on them for this attitude. That is from Bob. Din translates that earlier phrase, Samgo lo yan yak go hoi, three women, one market. Thank you very much indeed for that. Jim H. says, I've travelled long haul from Hong Kong since the 80s using the same three-person agent shop. Not a single time have they failed my travel need at home or with difficulties overseas. The dedicated people are under financial stress at this time. My question, what support may they receive to save their job? And he says, I'm currently booking September to travel Hong Kong, Tokyo, USA, there is no issues of concern. That's from Jim H.
And a question for David Webb from John. John says, sorry, this is off topic, but maybe David would like to answer it. And John says, some years ago, well before the events of 2019, David Webb wrote an essay about why Hong Kong's then situation of liberty without democracy was unsustainable, forecasting an ineluctable expansion of thought speech controls and reduction of democracy. In light of all that has happened, this essay seems remarkably prescient. But I'm working from memory and would like to review the text. Is it published online somewhere? David Webb, doesn't this relate to the piece you posted yesterday about 30 years in Hong Kong?
Yes, if you go to the latest article on website.com, and in there there's a link to my article of 2019 when I basically mapped out what's happening now in terms of purging negative thoughts in the civil service and schools and so on, and clamping down on the pandemocrats and viterating the legislature. So yes, it was unstable. It was going to tip one way or the other. I was always hopeful that it could, we could abolish corporate voting and create a proper electoral college to elect the chief executive, and that would work within the basic law without disturbing the 2014 decision. Clearly Beijing had other ideas and wanted to go with the authoritarian route, and that's where we are, that's where we've landed. And now we just have to live with it until China's ready to change its system, which I think it's a question of until rather than if. At some point it will need to do that to maintain economic growth, but maybe not in my lifetime now.
Well, this is slightly off topic, but our listener asked it. You're saying it was always unstable, it was always going to tip, so what happened at some point?
It was an almost unique combination of free speech and no democracy. You don't see that elsewhere in the world. You see, authoritarian rule in some places and very open societies in others. It wasn't going to last forever, and it was tested several times, and now it's fallen over. We had the national curriculum thing in 2012, which was dropped by the government. Before that, in 2003, we had the national security legislation, Article 23, which was dropped. So each time the bomb was defused, and this time it wasn't. So
if it hadn't been the extradition bill, it probably would have been something else.
Well, all of those were self-inflicted by the government, of course, and so the extradition bill was the latest one, and that's the one that broke the system. And,
but, I mean, if you're saying that it was unstable, it was going to tip, as I said, yes. If it hadn't been the extradition bill, something else probably would have come along a few years later.
Sooner or later, we would have to deal with those contradictions, as they say up north, that's where it's come down. RTHK is under threat. I don't know how long you'll have an English channel, for example, or if you do, whether you'll allow live discussions like we have now rather than filtered ones on recordings.
Well, there are English channels in China. I mean, you have English channels all over Asia, regardless of the system of government.
Well, I'm not in China, in the mainland. I'm in Hong Kong, China, so I can't speak to that. But I don't believe that you have free and open discussion on the airwaves of China in English, do you?
Just returning to about the art, is there anything that you forecast that hasn't happened, or that you in your so many things did happen that you say you forecast? Just turn it round. Things that you expected in this worst case scenario.
Well, I'm glad that it wasn't a bloody crackdown. There was that possibility, and I outlined in the article I wrote that I was also dealing with the aftermath of it and talking about the possible things that would happen in terms of overseas reactions and what's happened here as well. But we got here without having a bloody crackdown, and that's obviously a good thing from a humanity perspective.
Would you expect the government so-called laissez-faire attitude to change?
That's the issue. You see, as I said in yesterday's article, it's not impossible for an authoritarian government to make free market choices in its policies. Those are not inconsistent. So there's no reason why under the new era in Hong Kong, the government can't remove legislative hurdles to competition and go after entrenched oligopolies and monopolies and make a more efficient economy. They could do that. Since that's the only wiggle room left, I'll be, what public time I have in terms of public affairs, I'll be trying to nudge the policymakers in that direction still, and asking questions like, why do we still have a cap on the number of taxis and basically illegal ride-sharing services? Why do we have a cap on the number of buses? If we're talking about reviving tourism, then there's a cap on the number of non-franchised buses, and school buses compete with tourists to use those. There's plenty of things that we can do.
Because there's kind of muttering about that, isn't there? And there's sort of pressure from FTU and so on to sort of take on the tycoons. And, people have talked about this now as an opportunity to take on the rich people who've dominated the Hong Kong economy.
Well, it remains to be seen whether that happens.
Well, exactly, yeah.
Because
I don't know how that's going to materialise.
It depends what Beijing wants, obviously. The corporate voting is more powerful than ever under the new LegCo structure. And in the election committee as well. They haven't gone away from corporate voting. They've introduced more of it. But whether those people will all just do what's asked of them and not get in the way of reforms, That's a separate question.
But the traditional sectoral interests in the Hong Kong businesses are less powerful. They're swamped in the Legislative Council now by Election Committee, and the Election Committee is a sort of itself restructured, so you have all these representatives of mainland organisations put on. So your taxi industry doesn't have quite the same clout that they used to.
There's still a transport legislator in an expanded LegCo, but it's one of 90 rather than one of 70. And you know, there's still transport seats in the election committee. So, of course, mainland businesses also have interests in Hong Kong too. So whether they'll want to
probably not in the taxi
overturn.
Not in the taxi trade probably
no. So you know, there's still hope for running Hong Kong more efficiently under an authoritarian system. I mean, you know, if you look at some other places, then they've you know, Singapore, for example, although it does have a parliamentary democracy, it's been the same party that's been running the country since independence in 1965. But they've introduced much more competition in things like taxes and electricity production. There's competing generators and distributors.
Well, how about that? The example, I mean, you'll be well aware of the School of Academic Literature that says it's actually easier to introduce these kind of reforms in authoritarian society.
Well, yeah, so you don't have any long debates in LegCo anymore.
Unless, them what to do, and you don't care so much about the
unless they want to get a call.
Best interest.
Well, they want to get a call from the liaison office for getting in the way, you know. So you know, the liaison office could quickly pull them into line if it wanted to. Maybe some things positive will get done, but there's also a temptation to do more and more draconian legislation and crack down on access to information, for example, in the company's registry, or introduce tighter privacy laws which make it difficult to do news coverage. I mean, there's one proposal, I don't know if it's still on the drawing board, to say that people cannot be identifiable in media coverage, and that means that all faces in a crowd would have to be blanked out. Because otherwise their mum might recognise them in the crowd. Rather than being identified, saying this is a picture of Danny Gittings or Hugh Chiverton at such and such place. That would be an invasion of his privacy. But simply taking crowd scenes and street scenes and so on shouldn't be a problem. Anyway, we're kind of way off your topic, but I'm happy to carry on.
If you don't mind.
if you want to.
Yeah, we'll just pick your brains. I can say Carrie Lam is doing all these she's talked about these consultations and so on. She's doing a series of radio interviews.
It's noticeable in the last few days even that our leader has started appearing more on radio shows, and obviously there's an election coming up, so everyone's wondering whether Beijing is going to allow her to run a second time and win a second time.
So you think the two are connected, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone knows the answer to that yet. Maybe she doesn't either.
All right.
What
would you like to ask Carrie Lam if you were going to interview her?
Oh, there's a long list. I'd have to think about that. I only have a short amount of time to do it. No, I'm not going to get into that now.
Okay, in that case, so let's take you back to the Hong Kong-Singapore comparison, because you raised that. I mean, where do you stand on that? Because there are a lot of contrasting opinions about that now. You hear people saying that Hong Kong will have less freedom than Singapore because Singapore's an independent country. But on the other hand, you look at various indexes, even press freedom, where people talk about how much press freedom has deteriorated in Hong Kong, but still a long way, on any index, a long way ahead of Singapore.
Well, that was one of Hong Kong's competitive advantages before.
And it still is, actually. I know the difference is narrow, but it still is. You look at it, Hong Kong is still a long way above Singapore on the indexes.
Well, the indexes haven't yet been recalibrated, remeasured since Apple Daily closed. I don't think there's been a new index after that, and Stand News has withdrawn all of its opinion pieces from its
site.
There
are many other, I could mention academic conferences where we talked about the national security law, and people pointed out that you would never be able to have a discussion like that in Singapore ISA. I mean,
yeah, and you wouldn't be able to start up and run Apple Daily in Singapore. It wouldn't have happened. But of course, it does happen. It did happen in Hong Kong, and it does happen in Taiwan. They've got free media in Taiwan. So, between Taiwan and Hong Kong, clearly Taiwan is now in the lead of in terms of freedom of the media. That's That's just the way it is.
That's a rather easier comparison, Taiwan versus Hong Kong. I take you back to Singapore versus Hong Kong. Is there still a certain extent where you can say that in various areas we still do have more freedom than in Singapore?
Well, I'm not an expert on comparative analysis of media freedoms. You probably know more than I do about that. But clearly you are free in both places still, I hope. I mean, because that's what I do, to criticize policy making, to try to contribute constructively to better policy making and criticize bad policies. We've been talking this morning about tourism and immigration and quarantine and so on and all those things. There's a healthy debate on the subject. So I hope that once things settle down and the courts start to define the red lines better, that Hong Kong can still carry on within that narrower framework.
Do you think we're moving towards a new equilibrium, which would be very different from where we were a year or two ago, but it might stabilise at the current level?
That's what I was predicting, that you had to go one way or the other into a stable equilibrium from an unstable one. When you balance a pencil on its base, if it's got a flat base, it's still quite likely to fall over one way or the other. Or a ball on the top of a hill will fall down into the valley on one side or the other. We have now reached, or are close to reaching, the bottom of the authoritarian valley. I hope things won't get much worse.
Are we at the bottom? Why do you think we're at the bottom? I mean,
I said or close to it, because I can't rule out the possibility that live discussions like this might be removed from the airwaves, rather in order to filter out what I'm saying. At which point, I would stop coming on your air. I want them to be able to be unfiltered. Within reason,
People might have thought that we reached an equilibrium 6 months ago with Apple Daily still allowed to exist, and you discovered there wasn't. So why should it be the equilibrium now, as opposed to?
Well, I don't think you can have a negative amount of Apple Daily. I mean, you could probably have a zero amount of that, and that's gone.
But there are other things that could disappear apart from Apple Daily.
Yes. There are still, I talk to the media a lot, as and editors and so on, and there are still concerns about whether they can report what people like Nathan Law are saying, for example, or is the report itself going to be a banned thing? Because effectively you're giving him a voice on their publication. Will we reach what levels of censorship that happened in the UK during the troubles in Northern Ireland, where it was illegal to broadcast the voice of Sinn Féin people, the political party of the IRA? So you couldn't broadcast the voice of Gerry Adams, and the BBC got around it by using voice actors to repeat what he was saying. You could end up with more draconian controls over the media, or some sort of licensing system that bit harder. So we're not necessarily at the bottom of the authoritarian valley, but we're rolling around it. Rolling around that stable equilibrium point rather than trying to balance on the top of the hill.
Of course, a lot of people say it's out of Hong Kong's control. It depends on broader geopolitical issues, particularly Sino-US relations. We're expecting further sanctions to be announced by the US today.
Well, I'm sure you're not advocating them.
No, of course not. We are discussing what the impact. I mean, that if these things are outside Hong Kong's control and you have further sanctions and various measures announced by the US, is it possible we'll see a further deterioration?
It's possible. There was something that I described when the man was in office called the Trump dump as a possible action. I predicted and what they actually did was to start ordering U.S. investors not to invest in certain Chinese stocks that were linked to the mainland government. They just before the end of his term, they did start doing that. And for a while, it looked like the tracker fund would have to find a new manager. It might still, because it was run by an American fund manager and it was buying some of the banned stocks in the Hang Seng Index. So there could be more of those kinds of actions. And clearly, there's a sort of overall global disengagement going on from with China in terms of trying to be more independent of Chinese production and also disengagement from Asia somewhat. There's concern about TSMC, the biggest foundry in Taiwan, and the chip shortages. And so America has now passed a bill, or is going to spend $50 billion on subsidizing its own chip fabrications to disengage and be less reliant on Asian imports. So we might see more of that.
We might do, but I don't really see any kind of economic impact in Hong Kong from, as you say, there are a lot of kind of cultural, social changes, political changes, but I just don't see the business impact. Really.
Well, actually, it just kind of moves things around somewhat. We're more reliant on mainland capital through the Southbound Connect to buy stocks that, if Americans are banned from buying them, or European asset managers that haven't been banned and probably won't be from buying those stocks. And listings, they're actually coming home because the mainland companies are delisting from U.S. exchanges or being required to because of concerns over audit supervision. The U.S. auditing supervisor can't access all the papers that it would like to inspect auditors. And so more and more companies are being nudged towards the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. Obviously, that's good business for Hong Kong. And we've seen that recently with tech companies and three companies that were recently listed in the U.S. Were called in and inspected in parts of their business by mainland authorities. And there was a hint there that perhaps they shouldn't have listed in the U.S. in the first place.
And the property...
There used to be a badge of pride that you could be listed on New York Stock Exchange. Back in 2000, China Mobile went there and got listed, and you know, big fanfare and so on. But now, with the new, stronger, more confident mainland economy and government, they don't like the idea of foreign regulators supervising Chinese firms.
So there'd still be a space for Hong Kong. In fact, Hong Kong could be boosted.
Indeed, until capital controls are abolished, and that may be another long decade at least. Hong Kong is the only international capital market
and we will
on
live
mainland
off,
soil.
We will live off IPOs, which is a precarious kind of
well, it's
income, isn't it?
It's a business. Around that you get auditors, lawyers, bankers, printers. There's certain amount of and stockbrokers. A certain amount of activity around it.
Milk powder and
Hong Kong ought to be aiming to be more of an Asian hub. But I've always said that with a stock market. Trying to win business from the subcritical markets around the region that don't have very big stock exchanges of their own, and we should be doing much more of that, as London does for Europe and Eastern Europe.
Plus, we used to survive on plastic flowers, didn't we? And wigs was a big thing. So,
yeah, there's a reindustrialization. I mean, this is another example of central planning. So, saying earlier that we can, if we want, do less central planning under an authoritarian regime, but there's no sign of it yet. Instead, there's much more of it. There's money going into subsidized factories in industrial estates and expanding the cyberport, you know, to give the white elephant a baby elephant. And, expansion of the ever loss-making Ocean Park and continuation of Disneyland and when that would make a wonderful housing estate, that piece of land over there. And Penny's Bay, once we have, you know, if we ever close the quarantine center there, which is kind of dormant at the moment, but, you know, it's looking more and more permanent. If we ever close that, and there's a huge housing estate to be made, and a whole city could spring up.
This is a topic for another day, but you'd probably close Disneyland as well, wouldn't you, right?
Well, you would close Disneyland and Penny's Bay. And sell off the site in parcels to create a new city quite close to the airport through a existing rail connection and so on. There's a big part of our land shortage, and maybe you don't need to do the land tell tomorrow thing. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to wrap it up there, but we might ask Mike Rouse about that on Monday.
Yeah. David Webb, many thanks for
you're welcome.
Comment, not just on today's issue, but many related and unrelated topics as well. David Webb, the founder and editor of website.com, and you can have a look at that 30 years of living in Hong Kong essay on that website. Thanks very much indeed for that.